Today on Against the Grain, it's been called the greatest political film of all time. The Battle of Algiers, which was released 50 years ago, told the story of the Algerian people's struggle against French colonialism. It became an instant classic and touchstone for radical movements in the Third World and the international left. And it became a tool for study by those bent on crushing insurgencies from Uruguay to the Pentagon. I'm Sasha Lilly. Scholar Sohail Dalitzai joins me to reflect on the film's history and shifting impact on the world. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. When the Battle of Algiers hit the screens in 1966, it caused shockwaves around the world. The film recounted the struggle over the city in the mid-1950s by the Algerian National Liberation Front, or FLN, against the French colonial state. Powerfully, it documented the insurgency and its crushing by the French, a defeat that was ultimately on the path to victory by the FLN. The film was an Algerian-Italian production, directed by communist filmmaker Gillo Pontecorvo in collaboration with Sadi Yassev, a military commander of the FLN who appears in the film. It inspired national liberation struggles everywhere and had enormous impact on so-called third cinema coming out of the cultural ferment against colonialism. Much has been written about the making of the film, but scholar Sohail Dalitzai suggests that the afterlife of the Battle of Algiers helps illuminate our present in disturbing ways. Dalitzai, who joins me today, teaches in the departments of Film and Media Studies, African American Studies, and Global Middle East Studies at UC Irvine. He's the author of 50 Years of the Battle of Algiers, Past as Prologue, published by the University of Minnesota Press. So, Hale, let's start by talking about the context in which the film came to be. Can you remind our listeners of the wave of decolonization that swept the world and was accelerated by World War II?
I mean, that's a great question. I think, you know, to understand the Battle of Algiers as a film and its even contemporary relevance is to really situate it or think about it in the moment in which it emerged, which is that moment of decolonization that you're referring to. And I mean, it was a period of massive global upheaval where, you know, the legacies and Europe, of European colonialism, you know, direct European colonialism through direct rule and the French form of settler colonialisms and British indirect rule and the Belgians and the Congo, you know, that was being challenged across the world, throughout the continent of Africa, throughout Asia, including what we would now refer to as the Middle East. And you know, of course, this coincides with the massive kind of you know, black liberation movements that were taking place after World War II as well, and I'm sure maybe we'll talk about. But in order to understand the film, you have to understand that context. And I know, and I talk about in the book, World War II is this really pivotal moment, and I think it's really important to position it and situate it in the context of World War II, because I think you know, World War II gets framed, as I talk about in the book, in a couple of different the dominant way is that there was the British and the French and the United States, and they were fighting against the forces of fascism. So that, you know, as we're told, it was a war against a fascism against freedom. You know, the Germans, the Italians, the Japanese represented kind of fascism and evil, and the British and the French and the United States represented the forces of freedom. And we're told about Hitler and Nazism and master race philosophy. But as I talk about in the book, Aimé Césaire, you know, kind of Martinican anti-colonial thinker and poet, wrote this incredible book called Discourse on Colonialism. And in the book, he basically calls out the hypocrisies of the war, and in particular, the hypocrisies of the French and the British when it came to Nazism. Essentially, he says that, you know, you, the French and the British, have a Hitler inside you, right? That the only reason that the French and the British are asking us, their colonial subjects, to fight on the side, on their side against Hitler, is because Hitler is now doing to the French and the British what the British and French have been doing to the Third World for centuries, right? And that is to say that the British and French are also operating on the assumptions of master race philosophy, right? So this became like a really kind of complicated moment for the Third World in relationship to the European powers, because, like I said, you know, the dominant narrative around the war is that the British and the French won it. Well, no, their colonial subjects won the war. You know, there were a large number of colonial subjects who fought on the side of the British and French against Hitler. But what César was pointing out was that central to this thing called modernity and the Enlightenment was also and also then fascism, which is an outgrowth of it, is colonialism, right? And that is to say that to the Third World, there was no difference between the French and the British and the Germans, right? And of course, we can look at it through the lens of black soldiers who fought on the side of the United States, who, when they went to go fight in World War II, not only were they subject to all kinds of racism and degradation on the battlefront in Europe and the different theaters of war, but when they came back to the United States, lynching was a national sport, and they were still in a very segregated, Jim Crow, highly racially violent environment, right? So where, if the war was about ending master race philosophy, then why was it still enduring in the United States? And why, when it came to the French and the British after the war, did the colonies, so-called, not, you know, gain their freedom? So I kind of lay out this context and talk about this moment as very important, because while many French, while many Algerians, North Africans, West Africans did fight for the French, as did many, you know, South Asians, what are now Indian, Pakistan, Bangladesh, did fight for the British, they were given concessions. Part of this quid pro quo was, all right, you'll allow us to publish newspapers, you'll allow us to rally and form political parties and vote and gain our independence. In the case of the French, you know, and this is what I talk about in the book, there was a big massacre on May 1st in Sétif in Algeria in 1945, the very same day as VJ Day, where the Europeans are celebrating the victory. And the Algerians marched saying, okay, we contributed to the war effort, we helped save France, but now we want our own freedom. If the war was about ending, if the war was about self-determination and democracy and saving the world for that, and we want ours. And what the French ended up doing was just massacring the Algerians in Sétif on May 1st, right? And over several days, estimates ranged up to 30,000 Algerians were massacred. And it was a kind of signal to the Third World that European colonization was going to continue and white supremacy was going to be maintained. So as a result of that, you know, and the ways in which the British tried to maintain their colonies and the French tried to maintain their colonies and the United States was trying to deepen and maintain racial segregation and white supremacy as the law of the land, you then had, as a result, throughout the Third World, a massive upsurge in anti-colonial struggle.
Was there something that also changed when the colonizers, and you said, although it's not well known in the United States, that World War II was fought extensively by the colonized in armies supporting Britain and France and so on. Did it change the dynamic when these people were asked to sacrifice, but also to take up arms in defense of the colonizing power?
It absolutely did. I mean, you know, and I don't want to suggest that after World War II is when the Global South, or what was referred to as the Third World, that's when it began. They began their rebellions. They were rebelling the moment the Europeans landed on their soil. If you look at Algeria, there's an iconic figure, Amir Abdelkader, who him and his army were fighting a guerrilla war against the French the moment the French arrived in Algeria. And throughout the Third World, throughout Africa, throughout Asia, there was a constant rebellion against these colonial forces. But what World War II did do was it changed the nature of the conversation, because now you had European powers pitting themselves against each other. And this is the important point, right? Hitler invaded Britain and France and bombed Britain and France because, as payback for World War I, he wanted what the British and French had, which was the colonies and the wealth that it produced, right? So the wars, World War I, but especially World War II, was about control over the non-white world, right? And who had access to those resources? And who had control over these bodies and nations? So for the third world, this became abundantly clear. And I think Cesar's argument and Cesar's, you know, claims and the way he would pointed out these hypocrisies rang true. Not that everybody read Cesar, but they felt it. They experienced it. They understood it. And so when the claims came about, started to become about save the world for democracy and freedom and self-determination, you know, it came to a point where after centuries of this, the third world was like, well, wait a minute. Why doesn't that apply to us if you're using it in this way? And then you're asking us to sacrifice our lives. So the way in which then, you know, the war like inaugurated or opened up a space for thinking about, you know, these questions, I think did change the dynamic in a fundamental way. And, you know, truth be told, Europe and the colonial powers were weakened because of Hitler and the Italians and the war. So as a result of those several different forces, the third world had a little bit more space to move around. They had rhetorical and ideological and even an ethical levers to pull upon, that is to say democracy, freedom, self-determination. But because of the weakening of the British and the French in particular, they were able to kind of like craft more space and expand their, you know, anti-colonial fights. And because of things like Sétif and the kind of crushing of different rebellions, you know, armed struggle came to be seen throughout the Third World as more and more necessary in the fight against the colonial powers, right? So that's why a figure like Fanon emerges and his book, The Wretched of the Earth. You know, it's not that Fanon came up with the idea first, but Fanon is capturing a particular spirit. And you know, while the Third World is going through this kind of upheaval, you know, there's a tremendous amount of solidarity. So there's the Bandung Conference in 1954, right, which is the Afro-Asian Conference in Bandung, Indonesia. And Malcolm X talks about this in his famous message to the grassroots speech. There's the follow-up in Egypt of the conference in Cairo as a follow-up to Bandung. There's the 1961 meeting in Belgrade of the non-aligned movement, right? The Third World was like, look, we don't want to have to choose between the United States and the Soviet Union in this kind of Cold War politic. We want to determine our own freedom. And then, of course, there's the 1966 formation of the Tricontinental, which was a more militant kind of stand that formed in Cuba and Havana, that was like, you know, wanting to include black peoples in the United States and other black and brown and even Asian groups who were fighting for self-determination here. The Tricontinental was, you know, more militant in its advocacy of armed struggle as a tool for anti-imperial, for freedom in the anti-imperial struggle. So you had these kind of conventions and gatherings and conferences. You had artistic formations that emerged, whether it be the Lotus Project coming out of Lebanon, of Afro-Asian writers, OSPAL, the Organization of Solidarity with the Peoples of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and Havana, which is political poster art. You had the Black Arts Movement here in the United States. As I talk about in the book, Third Cinema became the radical way of thinking about the role of film within forming a revolutionary consciousness. And so, but you also had like diplomatic channels opened up. Training was being done across borders. You know, Nelson Mandela comes to FLN training camps in North Africa to train when he's fighting the apartheid regime in South Africa. You know, there's weapons are being exchanged and funded to different anti-imperial struggles. As I talk about in the book, you know, the Algerians in particular were very influenced by what Fidel Castro was doing. They saw themselves as the Cuba of Africa. They wanted to do what Castro was doing through Cuba in terms of like exporting kind of anti-imperial struggle. So Algeria, even before it got its own freedom, with the assistance of France Fanon, they're going to places like Ghana where Kwame Nkrumah was friendly to them, and they're making speeches and opening up diplomatic offices. And there's a whole host of kind of ways in which they're supporting different kind of anti-colonial struggles throughout the continent through diplomatic means, through funds, through weapons, and also art and culture became a big part of this conversation as well. So sure. This is something that was global in scope and also included, as I talk about in previous work, but a little bit in this book too, like Black freedom struggles here in the United States. You know, I talk about how Malcolm X is invoking the Algerian struggle and the Mau Mau and the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the victory of the Vietnamese against the French in 1954, Robert Williams's work, the travel of several kind of Black artists and writers to Algeria or to Paris in support of the Algerians, James Baldwin included in that. And then, of course, the Black Panther Party, right, who open up their first international office in Algiers, right? Eldridge Cleaver comes out of hiding with Kathleen Cleaver after they had fled to Cuba, and they appear in Algiers. And so Algiers had this kind of really iconic place within the Third World imagination, and particularly for Black freedom struggles here in the United States. This was something that was global, it was interdependent, and it was a kind of wave of anti-colonial solidarity against Europe and the United States and their attempt to continue to control the majority of the non-white world.
And I want to ask you some more about that kind of tremendous political and cultural ferment that accompanied decolonization and the rise of this sort of third worldist revolutionary internationalism. And I should say that I'm speaking with Sohail Dolatzai. He is author of 50 Years of the Battle of Algiers, Past as Prologue. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let's focus for a moment, though, on the history that leads up to Algeria becoming this touchstone for a certain kind of liberatory politics. And that is the history of French colonialism in Algeria. What sort of power was France? And tell us about the importance of Algeria to the French state, their reluctance to relinquish it in the wave of decolonization, the extent of the kind of brutality that they expended to try and hold on to Algeria, and what the nature of the rebellion was for Algeria's independence.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and I'll do my best to try and answer it in a short period of time. I mean, of course, the French, you know, begin colonizing Algeria in 1830. So when the war formally ends, it's roughly 130 years of French colonialism in Algeria. And for the French, because of its proximity, because of Algeria's proximity to France, you know, just across the way, you know, Algeria became kind of central to the French state. I mean, of course, it obviously leads to, you know, in many ways, the undermining of the French state as the Algerian rebellion kicks off in 1954, right? The French have already experienced a defeat in what they called Indochina and Vietnam with Dien Bien Phu. And so they've already experienced a defeat there. And they feel like the empire crumbling, as did the British, right? They felt that, like, this kind of, legacy of French Enlightenment ideals, and for the British it was very much the same thing, was in decline, and they felt the ground under their feet, like, literally shifting. And so there was a crisis within both the French and the British kind of political culture about how do we maintain our control. And of course, Winston Churchill, through the Atlantic Charter with the United States and the formation of NATO, was centrally about the maintaining of the colonies. You know, the United States and the Marshall Plan was about trying to give the British and the French the resources to maintain their hold on their colonies. And I talk about that a little bit when I say that after World War II, when the Cold War emerges, you know, the United States felt that, like, communism was a bigger threat to the Third World than was colonialism, right? That is to say, if the Third World got their freedom, the United States thought it would create a vacuum, and then communism would imprint itself and enter and have an influence in the Third World, and that was a threat to U.S. interests. So instead of having that possibly happen, the United States tried to maintain colonialism. So they funded the British and the French, and they themselves began to expand their influence into the Third World after World War II to maintain colonial relationships. They did not want the Third World to gain its freedom. So as I talk about, the Cold War, as we come to know it, is really a coded race war of the white world against the non-white world. I mean, it's not really talked about in those terms, but I think that's one way we have to look at it. But I say all that to say that, like, there was a tremendous amount of anxiety, in particular in France, over the loss of Algeria. So that all the way up until almost the late 90s, early 2000s, the French refused to call it a war, right? They didn't want to admit to it. It was akin to the trauma that the Vietnam War had on the national consciousness here in the United States, right? So there was a tremendous amount of political, economic, and military investment by the French into, you know, maintaining Algeria as a colony, right, of the French state. And, you know, it was called French Algeria. And there was a tremendous amount of struggle over what that would mean. And the French did a lot of different kinds of things in terms of legislation when they were trying to grant concessions. Do we give the Algerians a right to vote? Is it one-to-one? Is it one French vote to 8 Algerian votes? Which Algerians are voting? Are the Muslims voting? Is it the Algerian Jews? Is it Berbers? Is it different communities? Like, and there was a whole debate within the kind of French political establishment over how to maintain this control over Algeria, but essentially, you know, give some concessions to them so that we can kind of like take the steam out of the rebellion that they've experienced throughout their 130 years there. So, and in doing so, the French, you know, exacted an extremely heavy toll on the Algerians, so that not only in Algiers and the other bigger cities, but throughout the countryside, we're talking about massive displacement of Algerians. We're talking about the creation of detention camps, right? The seizing of land by the Algerians for French settlers to go in there and use the land for their purposes. We're talking about massive military bombardment and control over the Algerian population, extreme forms of violence. And I'm not even talking about the war yet from 1954 to 1962. I'm talking about the kinds of violence that were used to maintain French Algeria for the 130 years or 25 years right before the war ended, or the war started. So the French were extremely violent in their attempts to maintain their control over the Algerians. And, you know, I talk about this in the book a little bit because I think this is a part of the legacy of colonialism and just war more broadly that I don't think people necessarily account for. I think that we get caught up thinking about war as, and we get caught up in the kind of, you know, the spectacle of it. It's the bomb dropping, it's the drone, you know, it's the explosions, it's the shooting. But we're not really kind of clued into the other kind of violence that colonialism ushers in, which is a kind of, you know, what some scholars are called an epistemic violence, right? A violence to the very being of the native. This is what Fanon was getting at, right? So what does it mean to impose upon the Algerians that they have to speak the French language instead of Arabic, right? That they can't get married according to their own customs and traditions. They have to get married according to French law, right? That in schools, in public education, French history is being taught, not Algerian history, right? So what kind of damage does that do to the psyche? But also just what does extraction of resources do, and wealth, and the kind of decimation of Algerian social life? Like, what does colonialism do in those ways that I would argue is extremely violent, right? Not to mention the way in which enforced poverty is maintained, and that poverty is an extreme form of violence. So that, you know, we don't just see violence as a bomb dropping and casualties and death toll numbers, right? Which are significant because the French, you know, over their course of their, you know, killed millions of Algerians during their time in Algeria. But there's other forms of violence that I think are important to consider. And I think this comes back in the film in particular, because one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, many people argue that the film was balanced and that it showed both sides of the conflict. And it showed, you know, the Algerians bombing the cafes where the French were, but it also showed the French and their torture and the French bombing of the Casbah. And people suggest that, you know, through the use of music, that there was a kind of equation between these two kinds of bombings, and that, you know, the film is really, you know, a meditation on, you know, the sickness of war, and that violence affects both sides. And while that is true, I do think it misses the point that we're talking about vastly uneven playing fields here between the French and the Algerians. So I find it difficult and ethically troubling to equate, right, Algerian resistance to French colonialism and brutality with the French's brutality against the Algerians and that violence, right? So that is to say, the Algerians were using violence to tell the French, get your boot off my neck. And the French were saying, we're going to use even more violence to keep our boot on your neck. And I don't think that those are equatable kinds of violence.
And I would suggest, and I think you do as well in your book, 50 Years of the Battle of Algiers, that the film itself, although it does show, as you say, the violence of the victims as well as the violence of the victimizers, clearly one of the things that gave the film the enormous power and resonance that it had that made the Battle of Algiers such an important political intervention and cultural expression of that period of revolutionary third worldism was that it clearly had its sympathies on the side of the Algerian people, as much as it presented both sides in the way you've described. Clearly there is, as with most things, a perspective that is being emphasized. And it's an interesting perspective because it's not the perspective of a protagonist per se, but of a people themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is the power of the film. This is what made it so radical at the moment of its emergence, right? Is that, you know, here's a film that, you know, and I teach this in my film classes, and it's part of, this is what Third Cinema was trying to do, right? And it's the first time in a kind of, you know, very popular or public way that a film forced spectators to identify with the other, that is to say the non-European. Obviously, there were films shot in Algeria and North Africa throughout the kind of history of film, beginning in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and even all the way up until today, right? Like, the Third World has always been this kind of exotic backdrop to white anxiety or white neurosis or white people trying to resolve their issues, right? And we're always either the foil or just the kind of set piece to kind of give a kind of allure or exoticism to the film. But here was a film, The Battle of Algiers, that centered the Algerians within the narrative. They had linguistic dignity, right? They were able to speak their own language, right? They weren't being forced to speak French. And, you know, the film's power comes from its ability to have spectators identify with the Algerians and their resistance to the French. I mean, I think this is what, you know, is called subjectivity in some ways, right? So that even those really kind of, you know, kind of powerful scenes where the women are changing their clothes and they're going through the checkpoints, you're almost in some ways rooting for the women as they come through the checkpoints, right? You're rooting for the Algerians as a collective to overcome the forces of French colonial violence. And we can talk about, I think, later how this has shifted over in the post 9/11 moment, right? Because I think there's a different kind of reading that it gets done of the film. But when the film emerged, this is what made the film so powerful and why it became required viewing for the Black Panther Party, right? Why the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organ, was watching it, and why a whole host of other leftist groups, the Weathermen in the United States as well, Baader-Meinhof in Germany, and a whole host of other kinds of leftist radical militant groups were inspired and saw themselves as the Algerians. Right, there was a kind of universal appeal by the oppressed throughout the world with the Algerians, because this was the first time in a beautifully done way that people were able to identify and see themselves through the non-European in the other, so to speak. And this is, I think, the power of what Third Cinema was trying to do, and I talk about in my book, is that, you know, for Third Cinema and for the practitioners of Third Cinema, right, there was an intimate connection between film and the world outside of it, right? It wasn't what Hollywood or First Cinema or even European art house cinema saw as the role of film. That is to say, it was either entertainment, oh, let's just go watch a movie, escapism, or art house cinema that kind of got caught up in form and aesthetics and wasn't really about a kind of connection to the material world, right? Third Cinema saw itself as intimately in a dynamic or dialectic, if you will, with the world outside. So that if you walked into a film like The Battle of Algiers and you began to identify with the oppressed on screen, that would then force you, once you stepped out of the theater, you would then have to see the world differently. Like, you would have to then potentially identify with the oppressed in the world. And what would that mean to your worldview if you were able to then identify with the oppressed, or at the very least, start to begin to question the dominant ideas that were existing in the world, right? So this is the kind of connection that I think Third Cinema, but in particular The Battle of Algiers, was making to the outside world. And I think it also helps that on a formal and aesthetic level, The Battle of Algiers, like, has this kind of documentary newsreel style to it, right? It could have shot in color, but it chose black and white. It uses handheld cameras, right? The fact that there's no professional actors in the film except the Colonel Massieu, he was a theater actor coming out of Paris, right? He was the only professionally trained actor. Everybody else were everyday Algerians in the film, including Sadi Yassef, who plays himself, right?
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're speaking about the iconic film, The Battle of Algiers. I'm speaking with Sohail Dalatzai. He teaches in the Department of Film and Media Studies and African American Studies and Global Middle Eastern Studies at UC Irvine. He's the author of Black Star Crescent Moon and 50 Years of the Battle of Algiers, Past as Prologue, which is published by the University of Minnesota Press. And we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let me ask you about the actual making of the film, its genesis. Who made it and how was it made? Because that speaks to the, I think, resonance that the film ultimately had.
Yeah, absolutely. So the film was based upon the memoirs by Sadi Yassef. While he was the head of the FLN in the Kasbah, the military commander of the FLN in the Kasbah during the Battle of Algiers, that period of 1954 to 57 that the film covers. And as you see in the film, but also in real life, he was captured by the French, and he was one of the most wanted men within the kind of French Empire. And when they captured him while he was in prison, he wrote his memoirs, which were called Souvenirs of the Battle of Algiers. Once the war ended and, the Algerians had some modicum of independence and freedom, he decided, I want to make a film about this to kind of commemorate the Algerian struggle. So he decides to go to France and explore to see if there's some interest on the part of some French directors who, at this time, there's a kind of the French New Wave, and there's this kind of interesting kind of leftist cinema taking place in France. But no French director would touch the film, obviously, because this was still a huge issue within kind of France. And so he decides, well, let me go to Italy. Now, Italy at the time was the largest kind of film producer in Europe because of World War II. They had a kind of neorealist tradition. And Yassef goes to Italy to talk to several film directors. A couple of them have scheduling conflicts. And he ultimately kind of sits down with Guido Pontecorvo, who had done a film called Capo before. And when he sits down with Pontecorvo, he comes to find out that Pontecorvo himself, who was an Italian Marxist and part of the resistance in Italy against Mussolini, has already got a script about the Algerian war against the French for freedom. But Pontecorvo tells Yassef that, there's interest on the part of Paul Newman in the film. For him, Paul Newman was going to play this journalist, and he was this American journalist who was going to kind of see the war from both sides. And for Yassef, this was like not what he wanted to do, to say the least. Yassef had a treatment, and Pontecorvo saw that the treatment he felt was maybe too celebratory of the FLN. So they agreed that instead of either of these two, that Pontecorvo and Salinas would come to Algiers and with Yassef, based on his memoirs, meet people who had just fought in the war, come live there for 6 months, and then come up with a new script. So that's exactly what happened. They come to Algiers, and they talk to people. They go to the locations. They're doing their research. which includes reading Fanon's work, of course, Wretched of the Earth, because Fanon was part of the Algerian independence struggle and kind of worked at their newspaper, El Mujahid. And out of that, the film, a new script emerges. And this is significant, you know, so because, you know, the what Saadi Yassef wanted to do was he didn't want a single protagonist in the film, right? He wanted it to be a film about the Algerian people. And as I talk about in the book, this is a fundamental challenge to, you know, typical cinematic or film form, right? Sure. Like, usually we're told, you know, the film should follow an individual that people can empathize or identify with. And it's an emphasis on the individual, right? And so what ultimately comes out of that, even in kind of grand historical epics or political films, is we end up then focusing on this kind of great man kind of version of history, right? That it's one man, Gandhi, or one man, King, that freed the Indians or freed black people. And this is the narrative that gets imposed, that it's this great individual that led the people to the promised land, so to speak. And of course, that's fundamentally, as we know, if we understand social movements in history, not true, right? It's collectives that move history and that force change and that are the engines of radical social movements. And this is where Third Cinema was coming out of, and this is what Yassef was trying to suggest, is that, you know, we don't want to emphasize individuals in this film because it was a collective group of people who sacrificed a great deal to get to the place that we were in Algeria. So I think this is the value of seeing this kind of, you know, collective protagonist, or what was called a choral protagonist, in the Battle of Algiers. And so when they began shooting the film, of course, the film, as I mentioned, is being you know, there's no professional actors in the film, right? Except for Colonel Mathieu. But everybody else was non-professional. They were everyday Algerians. In fact, they were people who had, many of them who had just fought in the war directly or who were experiencing the war, right? This, we're talking about now 1964, 65, where they're starting to kind of undergo production, right? So this is within 2 to 3 years after the war just ended. So the film chooses to shoot in black and white when it could have done it in color. The technology was available, right? The film is using non-professional actors. It's using everyday people. And not just everyday people who had actually fought in the war. So it's really heightening this sense of realism, right? It's shooting in actual locations where the wars were actually fought. The milk bar where the bomb went off, right? The street scenes where clashes happened. Right, places in the Casbah where there was actual confrontations with the French, right? So actual locations are being utilized, non-professional actors, the use of black and white. You have this voiceover that gets used as this kind of like journalistic communiques. You have these press conferences. You have Saadi Yassef, who plays essentially himself in the film as Jafar, right? And so all of this is really about kind of heightening this sense of realism in the film. And I think that's the tension that I think is really interesting, is that when the film showed in the United States, they had to put a disclaimer at the beginning that said not one foot of newsreel footage was used in the making of this film, basically saying that what you're watching isn't a documentary, it's a fiction film, right? But if you watch the film and you know about its history, you know, I think part of the tension is that while it is a fiction film, it's a narrativized form of the actual war, there's a tremendous amount of realism within it. It's shot on the actual locations and these non-professional actors. So I think that tension that the film walks between documentary and fiction is really interesting. And I think that tension is what gives the film a lot of its power.
And you've been speaking about, and we've been speaking in the hour about, the tremendous power that this film has, the tremendous influence that it had, situated as it was within the explosion of radical social movements globally for decolonization and liberation. But the film proved not just popular for those on the radical left and those who subscribe to third world liberation, but also to those who were of a decidedly different orientation, and that is the far right. It became a lesson for those who were interested in counterinsurgency. Can you tell us about that other history of the film, that other life of the film, the way it lived on in a very different way for a very different audience than it was intended?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I'm sure many of the listeners know, and if they don't, you know, the Pentagon screened the film in 2003, you know, after the invasion of Iraq and then, of course, Afghanistan, right? They wanted to use the film as this kind of a way of thinking about how to crush an insurgency in Iraq and Afghanistan, right? But that wasn't the first time that this has happened. You know, when the film comes out, as I talk about in the book, right, the French school of counterinsurgency basically gets exported throughout the world. In fact, they're training U.S. soldiers and generals and military in terms of the Vietnam War, right? Like, so Operation Phoenix, which was the U.S.'s attempt to kind of, quote-unquote, pacify Saigon, was all based upon the French model of counterinsurgency that they used in the Battle of Algiers, and they used the film as a training tool for the U.S. military in Vietnam. But it also got used in South America and the CIA-backed Operation Condor that was bringing together many of the countries, Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, all the various countries in South America who were sharing intelligence to crush the kind of leftist uprisings that were happening. And the film was used as a training tool when many of these generals and military brass came to Washington, D.C., when they were training with what was called, what we all know as the School of the Assassins. The film was used as a training tool to help them understand how to do counterinsurgency work, right? Cordoning off areas, house-to-house sweeps, the use of torture. All of these things were being taught, and the film was the kind of visual accompaniment to all of that. So I talk about that in the book throughout the kind of legacy of the film over the last 50 years. You know, the way that it was pulled out of theaters, for example, in Uruguay after a record number of people went to watch the film, but because of the Tupamaros rebels that were kind of in the mountains and there was this kind of nascent uprising that was about to happen, the film is pulled out of the theaters in Uruguay and then used by the Uruguayan government, again, as a training tool to crush the Tupamaros, right? I talk about in Mexico City the year before, you know, the massacre at Tlatelolco and the 68 Olympics, the film is showing at the Cine de las Americas, and it's got, again, record-selling audiences, but the film is pulled out of the theaters. And so it's banned in various countries, apartheid South Africa, and different parts of the world are banning the film. And in Brazil, it was banned because they felt that, like, the people who were victims of the Brazilian military forces in the favelas and whatnot would identify with the Algerians. So they didn't allow the film to come into the country. So the film has this kind of interesting kind of history, all the way up until, like, you know, even the IOF, the Israeli Offensive Forces, right? Like, that the way in which they use the film to kind of crush Palestinian self-determination, right? And I talk about how, for example, in the massacre in Jenin, you know, the film was used as a training tool, as a way of kind of crushing kind of Palestinian struggles in occupied Palestine. So when we talk about then the embrace of the film by the Pentagon in 2003, this is not new, right? The film has this kind of really interesting history where it's being embraced by leftist kind of radical groups and artists and intellectuals, but it's also being embraced by kind of right-wing military juntas and kind of military regimes like the U.S. Pentagon and the British, who are trying to maintain control in Northern Ireland. So the film has this kind of interesting duality to it, and I think this is what, to me, is one of the most troubling aspects of it in the post 9/11 context, is the way in which, you know, the film and its legacies are trying to be rewritten, right? So that the film for the Pentagon becomes a way of the film becomes about how do you do counterinsurgency as opposed to how do a people organize and try to become free, right? So the film has fundamentally shifted its kind of moral center, if you will. And after 9/11, of course, you know, when people watch the film, it becomes a little bit more complicated because, as I talk about in the book, you know, because of the war on terror.
What's striking is that not that the Pentagon screened it in 2003, because as you say, there's a long history of the forces of repression, the far right, governments, the state, using the Battle of Algiers as a lesson tool for counterinsurgency. So in that sense, there's a continuity. But what is different is that when the Battle of Algiers was made, it was a film that, among other things, showed as sympathetic an armed struggle movement against a power where the people involved happened to be Muslims, whereas right. and was embraced universally for not because they were Muslims, but because they were fighting against colonial power. But now, obviously, the image of people who happen to be Muslims fighting back in an armed way is so charged, it immediately is something to be condemned. You know, this is a fearful sight. In a sense, without remembering the history that the film was produced in, if one were to watch it now through the lens of the present, you might end up with a very different notion of what the film was.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is the central point that I bring up in the book, that when the film came up, right, while the film was about, you know, incidentally, Muslims rebelling against the colonial power, it had a kind of universal appeal so that, you know, like as we've talked about, a lot of different groups all over the world saw themselves in the Algerians. It was just about a people struggling to be free. But I think in the post 9/11 context, that has been narrowed and collapsed. So the film doesn't necessarily have that same kind of universal appeal. Now it's only about Muslims who are fighting back with armed struggle and political violence, right? And so it doesn't have the same kind of universal appeal that it had in the previous era. And of course, that's because the era of decolonization and third world liberation struggles was so kind of, prominent, right? And there were coherent movements that had taken shape, right? But today, with a kind of absence around that, and then on top of that, with the kind of logic of the war on terror and how it's kind of racialized the figure of the Muslim, so that, as I suggest, right, the space for thinking about Muslim subjectivity, Muslim being, and even Muslim resistance has become so narrow that it's impossible for us to have a space now to look at the Battle of Algiers and see it with the same eyes that the film was intended to be seen with. That is to say, to give subjectivity and dignity to people who are resisting, who are also Muslim. And so it forecloses or collapses that space. And I think as a result, then, when people watch the film today, they're looking at it through the eyes of the post 9/11 moment. And so the scenes of the women and the bombs in the bag, that's a very uncomfortable scene. I mean, it was back in the day as well. I'm not trying to say that it was just some sort of uncritical celebration. But I think today it's read through the lens of the post 9/11 moment. And that, since that space has been narrowed around Muslim being and Muslim subjectivity, it doesn't allow for a space to begin to understand what that might be about, right? And how do we think today about Muslim resistance, right? So that Muslim resistance of any kind today, whether it be by word, by pen, by camera, or by gun, is completely unfathomable. It's not something that can even be understood because you're either with us, to quote George Bush, or you're with the terrorists. Right. And I think part of what I talk about in the book is even that language of terrorism is a very racially coded language. And that's central to why the film is being seen. I think it's viewed differently in today's context.
Do you have any sense of how the film is remembered now in Algeria, a country whose revolutionary past seems a distant memory? There has been a civil war. There's been a lot of brutal history since that initial euphoric period when this film came out.
I mean, I think, and that's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, what we're talking about is the fact that the FLN has been in power for over 50 years, right? I think even there's a scene in the film on the rooftop where Ali Lapointe and Ben Amidi, the kind of the leader, are talking about, the general strike and just the nature of revolutionary activity. And what Benamidi tells Ali Lapointe, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, is, look, it's hard enough to start a revolution. It's even harder to win one. But the hardest part is what we do after, right? And I think this became the tragedy of the third world idea, right? That is to say that self-determination and decolonization were never allowed to fully happen because through the IMF and the World Bank, the supporting of client states, the arming of opposition groups, the destruction of democratically elected processes, the assassination of people like Patrice Lumumba and Arbenz, the toppling of Mossadegh, right, that it kind of wreaked havoc throughout the third world, and that self-determination never really occurred, right? So that the reason why the Battle of Algiers continues to be relevant today is because the very forces, right, the very violent forces that made the film's creation a necessity are still with us today. That is to say, white supremacy is alive and well, racial capital is alive and well, exploitation of the global South is alive and well. And as long as those forces are still at play, the film will continue to be relevant. But in a place like Algeria, specifically, because the FLN has been kind of in power for this long period of time, I think there is a kind of uneasiness as a result of that, right? And then, like, what did our freedom and this sacrifice really give us, right? Where are we now 50 years afterwards? And again, it's not just Algeria. This is the story of the third world writ large, right? There's a big question about how do we undo this legacy of colonialism and empire? Because we're still very much subject to these same forces.
We're out of time. I've been speaking with the author of 50 Years of the Battle of Algiers, Past as Prologue. That's published by the University of Minnesota Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Sohail Dalatzai teaches in the departments of Film and Media Studies, African American Studies, and Global Middle East Studies at UC Irvine, and he's also the author of Black Star, Crescent Moon. Sohail, thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.